I'm Melissa Harris Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. In 2020, American police killed more than 1,000 people. 80 of those people were unarmed, and officers were charged with a crime in only 16 of those incidents. There was video in 8 of those 16, and one of those incidents ignited a social movement that led to the largest demonstrations in U.S. history. At 8:20 p.m. on May 25th, 2020, Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd on the streets of Minneapolis. And 17-year-old Darnella Frazier used her cell phone to capture the white Minneapolis police officer kneeling on Floyd's neck for a devastating 9 minutes and 29 seconds.
It was difficult because I felt like there wasn't really anything I could do as a bystander. The highest power was there, and I felt like I was feeling it.
Millions across the globe watched in disbelief as Officer Chauvin ignored George Floyd's pleas for breath.
I can breathe. Please, in the name of the...
In disbelief, millions saw the life leave Floyd's body, even as the knee remained on his neck. And despite the dangers of a global pandemic, millions of people took to the streets, reigniting the movement for Black lives. And in this wave of the movement, activists' demands shifted from reform to abolition, from investing in police training and technology to defunding the police. And as protesters took to these streets, they demanded racial justice, and they were met with harsh reaction by police officers.
We're trapped. They're shooting pepper balls at us. They've thrown out tear gas, flashbangs.
Earlier this year, a jury found Derek Chauvin, that former Minneapolis police officer, guilty of murder. And the city of Minneapolis promised to begin dismantling their police department. Now, Chauvin's conviction is definitely a rare event, heralded by some as a milestone in the fight for racial justice. But according to the Washington Post, 1 year since Floyd was murdered, over 900 people have been killed by police in this country. So all this hour, we're going to examine what has changed in the last year. We're going to talk about the future of the movement for racial justice. We're going to discuss how TV shows have portrayed the moment. But we're going to begin in Minneapolis. And I'm joined now by Andrea Jenkins, Vice President of the Minneapolis City Council. Andrea, it's great to have you back.
Hello, Melissa. How are you?
Hi. We're having that moment, and I'm thrilled that you are here to talk with us about it. We're also joined by Aaron Morrison, who is National Race and Ethnicity Writer for the Associated Press. Aaron, also thank you for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Melissa.
So, Andrea, I actually do want to start with you. What does it look like in Minneapolis today, 1 year since George Floyd was murdered?
You know, it's a beautiful, sunny day, but, you know, there's lots of tension. There's lots of, I think residual trauma. And as we continue to be traumatized, as been widely reported, Dante Wright was killed in the midst of the trial. So there's just still a lot of anxiety, a lot of angst. Crime has really gone up in the city of Minneapolis. And so while people are out and planning events to commemorate and have been all weekend, there's still a lot of tension as we get ready to see the other three officers go on trial. That's how I would describe it.
Andrea, can you walk with me for just a moment through that statement you made that crime has gone up in Minneapolis? How do we reconcile that with the calls to dismantle policing as we know it?
It is a really challenging juxtaposition. And, you know, we have to change the police department here in Minneapolis. And I believe the way policing operates throughout this nation, as you noted, over 900 people have been killed by the police since George Floyd's unfortunate, tragic demise. And so we have to change, but we still need professional, accountable, you know, law enforcement. And so it's a tough juxtaposition, but we have to work together to bring some positivity, safety, and accountability to this system that we are calling policing. Like everything in our society, things have changed and policing hasn't, and that's the problem. We gotta change policing.
So, Andrea, I want to pull Aaron in here on exactly that point, because Aaron, local communities ought not have to figure out something this complicated entirely on their own. What is the current state of federal reform around policing?
Well, it's, as far as we know, it's being investigated as we speak. The George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which was actually proposed pretty soon after George Floyd's murder last year, you know, it was passed by the House, and then it just sat and languished because there was no appetite to pass it in the Senate. Now that the Senate is very narrowly controlled by Democrats, that work has, you know, began again. It began again earlier this year, but there's still some sticking points on federal reform, and this is federal reform that would, you know, in a way incentivize local police departments to enact some of the sweeping reforms that activists, advocates have been calling for years.
Sure. And federal incentives matter a lot, right? We saw this after 9/11 when federal incentives around amping up police and police technology made huge differences in what was occurring for local communities engaging with what had previously felt like police forces and then began to feel like military.
Right. So what the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act does, one of the provisions is to limit now and ratchet back this transfer of military equipment that we saw go to local police departments, which they then used against the protesters who were, you know, out on the streets, standing up against what they saw happen to George Floyd, the literal lynching that they watched on live television.
Andrea, one important change was implemented around policing in Minneapolis fairly swiftly, but we didn't get to see its impact because of the nature of the pandemic. So it's my understanding that school resource officers will not be returning to the Minneapolis public schools. What does that look like, and how might that also be sort of a model for the kinds of reforms that you all can implement going forward?
So certainly that's a very true statement, and we really haven't seen, because the return to school is still quite spotty. Lots of distance learning continuing to happen. But I think, you know, we'll see more changes this coming fall. But, I what's going on, I think schools are hiring security officers, and I think we'll start to see more of that in our communities. Hopefully they're unarmed. I'm not quite sure. I think, you know, because we have a different school system that's separate from the city council, but I believe those security folks will be unarmed, and we'll see that kind of sort of privatization of security, if you will, I think in other parts of our society too. Certainly the city council is developing a non-armed mental health response. And, you know, I believe those kinds of responses are what we're going to see more of in the future, hopefully.
So Aaron, I want to play with that idea a little bit. What if, in fact, we were to see sort of more private security in neighborhoods, in communities, rather than those that have at least some level of accountability by working for the public? Is that the kind of reform that racial justice advocates are going for in this moment? Or does that actually potentially move us into even less accountability?
I would say the latter. I mean, absolutely not. I don't think anybody, certainly in the racial justice movement is calling for the, privatizing police or security. I mean, let's just remember Trayvon Martin was killed by someone who, was acting as a volunteer neighborhood watchman. So we know we've seen this episode before. We know what would happen. Particularly to people of color, to Black folks, if we moved in that direction. So there needs to be more accountability is what advocates have been saying, more accountability and not less. And privatizing just creates a whole new set of problems for the movement.
Aaron, you mentioned this idea that in the Senate right now, the George Floyd Policing Act is stuck. Might it be possible that it can become somewhat less stuck as a result of President Biden hosting George Floyd's family today? Is their presence potentially meaningful for moving the legislation?
I think so. This is not the first time that the family one has been in Washington to meet with lawmakers specifically on the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. However, I think on a day as significant as this, meeting with the Biden administration, meeting at the White House, meeting with the president, in addition to having some meetings with the lawmakers who are actually negotiating this, I think it seems like it could have an impact in moving it forward it would be sort of their 11th hour last plea to do something. It's been a year to do something that at least puts America on a path towards ending such an epidemic of violence against folks.
So Aaron, let's talk about how this wave of the movement for Black Lives really pushed out new ideas around how we can address policing and racial justice. Instead of hearing about body cams or implicit bias training, the language was defund and abolish. Can you talk about what defund means and what abolish might look like?
Well, I think pretty early on as that language emerged in the protests last year, it was seized upon as this very scary notion of when you defund the police, that somehow that means you're saying absolutely no police whatsoever, absolutely no public safety. And that is actually far from what activists were calling for last year and what they continue to call for today. What they're asking for is to take some of the money, some of the massive, really massive amounts of money that it goes to police budgets, and put some of that towards services that provide care to people so that they don't end up in these interactions with police officers that are often just, the consequences of poverty, the consequences of homelessness, the consequences of, not having enough income, not being employed.
So, Andrea, as a elected member of a city council, that's exactly the kind of work that you all might have to do, right? Take that city budget, look at it, and move resources from the police pot to another bucket. What does that look like for you in practice? What would that mean? And what would accountability look like for elected officials who do that?
Mm-hmm. So we have absolutely done that. And to be real clear, Melissa, we started sort of reallocating funds before the death of George Floyd. We have a very engaged activist community. And so my first year in office, we shifted $1 million from the police department to create the Office of Violence Prevention. And then subsequently, in just this past budget cycle, we shifted over $8 million to boost up that Office of Violence Prevention, to work with community-based groups to do what we call interruption and interruptors, to really engage with young people to prevent crime before it happens, particularly violent crime. And so we started that process. I have to admit, it is a very challenging place to be as a as an elected official, because, you know, a big part of our responsibility is public safety. However, that public safety cannot be at the expense of Black lives that seemingly are expendable to many police departments all around the country. You know, and I think that reallocation of funding is going to continue. We have our police budget last year was about $187 million. And that's a significant chunk of change in our overall budget. And we have to really, as Aaron noted, look at affordable housing, look at job training opportunities, look at universal basic income as ways to help families overcome some of these systemic and historic challenges that have been a part of Black life in America.
So, Aaron, both you and Andrea have pointed to some critical issues around economics, poverty, income inequality, but also to this kind of core question about the valuing of Black life. The idea that when we say public safety, Black folk ought to be not only part of that public, but maybe even central to it. Have we made progress on that part?
You know, it's hard to say, to be quite honest with you, because I think a lot of times when we've gone through these inflection, you know, periods or these moments, flashpoints, in our history, in the history of racial justice in America, there's often this push for fast solutions and fast results. So sometimes people are like, okay, so it's a year later, what has happened? Have we solved it yet? And quite honestly, this type of change, ending systemic racism, addressing systemic racism, is not something that you're going to solve overnight. It's obviously, it's not something that you're going to solve even in a year. So you can barely even begin to measure whether or not some of these changes are actually having the impact, the intended impact. So I think it's still to be seen if we are going to get to a place where these programs, the shift in funding, is actually making a difference.
Aaron, I so appreciate that point. I often remind young activists who I meet with or teach in my classes that, you know, we're probably not smarter, better, you know, cooler, more strategic than Ida Wells or Frederick Douglass or Anna Julia Cooper. And if it was easily solved, they would have already solved it, right? We are in a long set of struggles here. I love the one thing in particular I want to zoom in on, and that is the question of measuring it. Where are we on data collection around these questions?
So the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act also calls for the creation of not only better measures for tracking discriminatory policing. It's also calling for a database of misconduct of officers so that we can actually measure how often officers are being brought up on these types of investigations and what happens to them. Do they get to just jump around to different police departments when they get fired from one? Those are things that need to happen in order for us to really understand and measure the problem.
Aaron Morrison is a national race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press. And Andrea Jenkins is the vice president of the Minneapolis City Council. Andrea and Aaron, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, so much of last year, of the trauma, of the experiences, of the questions of racial justice uprisings, all of those things that occurred in the wake of Officer Chauvin murdering George Floyd, well, we processed them together on this show with you. So today, as we mark this tragic but critically important first anniversary, we asked whether you have noticed a change in your community or in the way that you think about systemic racism. And here's a little bit of what you told us.
Claire Anderson, St. Louis, Missouri. Has there been a change in the community since George Floyd's death a year ago? Yes, sirree, it's palpable. It's very in to support diversity. It's very in to connect with the other. Emoji smiley face, clapping hands, thumbs up emoji. Let's keep all that going. But doing the dismantling, that's different. That's difficult, complex. I don't know.
This is Lawrence McKenna. I'm from Brooklyn Center. I live in Champlin. Shout out to Minneapolis. I'm 43, and when Rodney King got beat by the LAPD and the riots happened, I thought that kind of thing would never happen again. And I thought by 2020, racism wouldn't even exist. And it's gotten worse than ever. Are we going to keep repeating history? Enough is enough.
This is John. I'm calling from Vashon Island, Washington. And I want to say that there's a great deal more awareness of the endemic racism in our culture. And to me personally, I saw a bumper sticker the other day that said, abolish the slave patrols. And a year ago, I wouldn't have had any clue as to what that was referring to.
Deborah from Salem, Oregon. And no, racists are still around, flying their flags, being idiots, and it sickens me how ignorant people can be. I have always been aware, raised our child to be inclusive to everyone, and try to be conscious of my white privilege.
Hi, this is Julie in Dallas. As a white, middle-aged woman, my eyes have been opened. Even as a progressive voter, I was not aware of the prevalence of day-to-day racism.
I have been reading more books about anti-racism and going out of my way to hire Black-owned businesses like our new plumber. I'm learning to be a better ally to my African-American brothers and sisters by calling out leaders, police, teachers, and others within my community for racist behaviors and microaggressions that perpetuate systemic racism. This is Nikki Muhammad Ghazi from Arlington.
This is Kazoo from Oakland. I've just been surprised that mainstream has been actually admitting what horrors have been going on for so long with our tax dollars after like just centuries and centuries of this oppression. So I've been in the streets myself, organizing for racial justice for a long time since I was a teenager. And, you know, I'm almost 40 now. And it's hard for me to imagine that the changes we need will actually happen. But I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that I'm going to be pleasantly surprised and that this is not just some apparition. Anyway, all power to the people.
Thank you for calling, for thinking, for reading, for your heart emojis. But most importantly, thank you to all of you for getting in here and trying to do the really hard work of democracy. As always, we love hearing from you, so give us a call anytime. The number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, in the immediate aftermath of George Floyd's murder last May, activists organized protests against police brutality in the biggest cities and smallest towns across the U.S., everywhere from New York City and Washington, D.C., to Portland, Maine, and Wilmington, North Carolina. We even saw protests reach communities with populations less than 1,000, like Millerton, New York, where at least one person stood with the Black Lives Matter sign. Now, several polls also estimate that between 15 and 26 million people in the U.S. participated in demonstrations last summer. In almost every pocket of the country, people marched and they chanted, they prayed, they knelt, they stood and sat and laid in silence for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. Even though we later learned Derek Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck for even longer, 9 minutes and 29 seconds. In some cities, protesters blocked freeways, they filled entire streets, they demanded justice for George Floyd, for Breonna Taylor, for Ahmaud Arbery, and so many others, all in the thick of a deadly global pandemic. And these mass public actions demanding justice were not restricted to the United States. People in Thailand, Argentina, Mexico, Japan, and across the globe demonstrated in solidarity with Black Americans. In the UK, people came together in London not only to condemn Floyd's murder, but also to protest the police violence and systemic racism, all too familiar in their own lives.
Justice for Black people! Justice for all Black people! Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
And at the heart of these global protests was a reckoning with the imperial histories and the racist practices that continue to shape the lives of marginalized and oppressed populations. In Bristol, a city in southwest England, protesters even toppled a statue of a 17th century slave trader and dumped it into the harbor. In France and Australia, the murder of George Floyd resonated with Black and Aboriginal people who are all too often killed in police custody. In Indonesia, the uprisings following Floyd's death inspired the indigenous Papuan population to take to the streets and to social media with Papuan Lives Matter. And in Nigeria, months after the summer's protest, the spirit of Black Lives Matter was felt during the country's hashtag End SARS movement, which called for the dissolution of the Special Anti-Robbery Squad due to its widespread abuses, including torture and killings. The culture and the politics of Black Americans has long been agenda setting for social movements around the world. And the global impact of George Floyd's murder and the movement it ignited is no exception. Here to discuss that and more is Omar Wasau. He is an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University. Omar, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Omar, clearly neither racial justice nor state violence are new or even particularly rare. So why is it that this moment resonated across the globe?
I think there are three main reasons that the murder of George Floyd was so powerful. First and foremost is the video, particularly Darnella Frazier's footage that just in a way that was just kind of very visceral, very intimate, very powerful, allowed people to see the profound indifference to human suffering that Officer Chauvin indicated as we could watch the life drain from George Floyd's face, right? So that footage really was exceedingly important. And that's an echo of what we've seen in the past where, whether it was Emmett Till or Rodney King, that documentation of, in particular, state violence can be very powerful at mobilizing people. Another really important factor is that the Chauvin himself was just so extreme in his level of indifference, right? This wasn't an ambiguous situation. I mean, it was just very stark, so much so that we saw other police forces criticize that behavior, I mean, which we almost never see. And then lastly, I think the timing in the midst of the pandemic meant that where, you know, one of the core challenges for any social movement is trying to, get a bunch of people to kind of show up at the same place at the same time. And people always have things going on in their lives. But during the pandemic, suddenly people were able to kind of focus on this particular injustice to a degree that would have been much harder without the pandemic.
I so appreciate that because it reminds us that protests don't just pop up. They don't just emerge. They are actually organized by activists who bring people together in those spaces. But they're also, right, in addition to the work of activists and organizers, there's also those, what you have written about as seeds, those seeds of an agenda. So actually just this week, you published an academic paper in the APSR titled Agenda Seeding and Thinking About 1960s Black Protest Movements. I'm wondering about the ways that Black American movements for freedom have seeded agendas abroad before. Is this something that we've seen happen?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, part of what is, for me, deeply fascinating about how social movements work is the way that they learn from each other. So, for example, just to go back to the 1940s, Bayard Rustin, a key influence on Martin Luther King's commitment to nonviolence, Rustin goes to India to learn from disciples of Gandhi about their non-cooperation movement. And we've seen similar echoes of the current Black Lives Matter movement on, as the introduction sort of really helpfully outlined, on movements around the world. And in particular, I think it's the emphasis on police violence, on unjust state violence, that has helped to focus kind of, you know, when those incidents arise in a place like Colombia in recent weeks, that people have described it as their own George Floyd moment, right? And so in that way, there's a kind of a template and a sense of legitimate outrage at state violence that helps to mobilize people building on what they've seen in Black Lives Matter in the U.S.
So I appreciate that you started with Rustin, because that shows us sort of the Black Atlantic, the currents moving the other way. But it does often feel as though it moves only sort of from U.S.-centric out. So I'm thinking of us learning just yesterday that Sasha Johnson, a Black Lives Matter activist in the U.K., is in critical condition after being shot. And we don't know from initial reports whether this shooting was directly related to her activism. But still, I wonder about, for example, the capacity of a Sasha Johnson to be a figure like George Floyd, also reigniting movements here in the U.S.
We definitely see this kind of cross-pollination happening in many different contexts. So, I mean, even, for example, there was the Tahrir Square protests in Egypt, and that helped influence the Occupy Wall Street protests in the United States. So some of that is about tactics. You know, there's a particular method of protest, like occupying a space. But in other cases, like what you're describing, there are ways in which an iconic figure can become a kind of rallying point for a movement, and we also see, just to kind of speak to the international dimensions, there are ways in which sometimes there are activists moving from one place to another, kind of learning from each other. So the scholar Zeynep Tufekci, for example, has talked about how people in Turkey who organized a protest in Istanbul also helped share some of the methods they learned with folks in Tahrir Square. So there is, and particularly in the age of the internet, there are ways in which people are communicating, sharing tactics, trying to figure out how can they get their voice heard. And in the particular case you're saying, it's obviously still too early to say whether the UK might influence the US in this specific case, but it certainly happened historically.
So you dropped social media there. So I just want to think about the ways, though, that has sometimes looked a little different relative to global actors. So, you know, we're being sort of celebratory of this idea of ideas and activism moving back and forth. But in the 2016 elections here in the U.S., foreign entities actually exploited Black Lives Matter language and images to work against, right, interests of racial justice. How can we sort of navigate that question of these illegitimate uses globally?
One of the core challenges for any social movement is to kind of capture the moral high ground and hold it. And there will always be a counter mobilization that tries to delegitimize the claims for equality or justice of that movement. And what I find in the 1960s is there are tactics. I mean, it requires often, kind of extreme kinds of methods, but making oneself the object of state violence, strategically doing that and getting media coverage of those kinds of attacks that of course can lead to trauma, injury, and death, but help to elevate an issue and do it in a way that is, sort of helps to just illuminate the injustice in a very profound way. That kind of tactic can work, but it's very hard to sustain.
Omar Wasso is an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University. He's also a little bit the whole reason that I know about the Black Planet and those questions of global organizing. Omar, thank you for your work for so long, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really grateful.
Look around you. Depictions of police are ubiquitous in American TV and film. Ratings-grabbing reality shows like Cops, scripted juggernauts like the Law & Order franchise, blockbuster films featuring megastars like Will Smith. And yeah, even children's cartoons. I mean, have you seen Paw Patrol? All reproduce core beliefs that surveillance, policing, interrogation, and incarceration serve the public good. But video evidence of Officer Derek Chauvin's lethal cruelty towards George Floyd called into question these deeply embedded assumptions and really forced Hollywood to reevaluate how it depicts police and policing. Reality shows, including Cops and Live PD, were canceled. Writers for scripted shows centered around policing, like Brooklyn Nine-Nine and SWAT, said they were rethinking how they depict police officers on their shows. And the uprisings also led to a number of long overdue changes. Multiple white actors announced they would no longer be voicing characters of color on animated shows. And The Bachelor announced its first Black lead. Now, 1 year since George Floyd's murder, a number of scripted television shows have attempted to incorporate the racial justice uprisings directly into their plots, with mixed results. Like in the recent episode of the ABC drama, A Million Little Things.
Hey, everything okay?
No.
What's going on?
Kiki sent me this video. His name was George Floyd.
With me now to talk about this year of race and change in Hollywood is Eric Deggans, the television critic for NPR. Nice to talk with you, Eric.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So how big of a deal was it when both Cops and Live PD were canceled last summer?
That was a huge deal because Cops was a franchise that had been around for something like 30 years. And Live PD was the A&E channel's highest rated show. So it wasn't a case of the industry turning its back on a little known show or a show that people didn't know or a show that wasn't making money. But critics like me have been complaining about these shows for a very long time. I've been critiquing Cops since at least the early 2000s. And, the big problem with it is the way that it sort of trivializes a lot of the issues that these cops are dealing with. The police have a tremendous amount of control over the footage. There's a sense that because there are these roving bands of camera people traveling with the cops that it encourages the police officers to overperform and overpolice and try to make something happen for the cameras. And the footage just becomes this litany of people who are, caught in terrible circumstances, but you rarely see their point of view. It is, people struggling with addiction, people making terrible choices, people at the worst moments of their lives, but it's all from the perspective of the police officer. And of course, there's a message that it sends about people of color and poor people. So I was overjoyed to see both of these shows go away. And I hope that we don't see them return anytime soon.
Now, presumably, scripted police procedurals would give the opportunity for writers to give us some of that other perspective that you're talking about, to tell us this story from a view that we don't get on those reality shows. But that doesn't seem to be what happens. The officers are still consistently the heroes.
Well, that's, you know, that's an interesting point. You know, I was talking with David Simon, the creator of The Wire, about this not too long ago. And he made a great point, which is that, you know, on most of these shows, the camera and therefore the perspective of the audience is always with the police officer. So that's, it's the police officer who's humanized, and the show was focused on them. So a show like Cop or like SWAT or FBI or Law and Order, it's always about the perspective of the police officers or the lawyer, the prosecutors. So you're encouraged to sympathize with them, identify with them, and see every story from their perspective. And so when you're trying to talk about something like systemic prejudice or racism in policing against people of color, you know, the place where you place the camera is not like with the cops. So that's why it's so hard for these shows, because the problem that people are trying to articulate about how people of color are being policed is that it's a system that co-opts and corrupts every cop that's a part of it. And even though police officers, there are a lot of great people who are police officers who want to do the right thing, the question is whether the system forces them into situations where they end up doing not great things. And so if the name of your show is FBI, or if the name of your show is SWAT, that can't be a message that the show can be comfortable transmitting. It's always got to be, number one, it's the thin blue line, you know, courageous cops are the protectors of society against terrible criminals. And also individual cops can be heroic and rise above whatever terrible decisions about policing produce incidents like what happened to George Floyd. And both of those ideas are things that society wants to believe, but not necessarily what happens in real life.
So let me ask this tough piece then, that now that we're a year in, can this moment be, in fact, transformational, given the systemic realities that you've just pointed out? Is it possible for us to see real, meaningful change in Hollywood?
I think it is possible for us to see different kinds of stories, but I don't think we're going to see those kinds of stories from your typical police procedurals on broadcast television, because, as I said, the whole framework of the narrative that they're telling just makes it impossible to do that. What's more likely, and also this takes time. You know, I remember when 9/11 happened, and there were TV shows that tried right away to tell stories that were related to 9/11. And they were kind of clunky and they were kind of awkward, because it takes time to process something that monumental and then create a piece of television that really speaks to it. And so I think part of the problem too is that, like, the industry had shut down over the summer. You had all these writers' rooms that were meeting by Zoom. George Floyd was killed in May. And so all these writers' rooms were starting up again. And you had all these writers that wanted to try and tackle this, but the impact was fresh. And they were working in these very narrow constraints, the shows that were already established, that already had their heroes and villains plotted out. What I'm expecting to see is new product that will be configured from the ground up to tell these stories in a way that makes sense and that gets at some of the structural inequalities and the systemic racism. That's what I'm waiting for. And that takes time.
Yes. And in that sense, I suppose change in policing, change in Hollywood is much like democracy itself. We got to process it, and it takes time to build something new. Eric Deggans, television critic for NPR, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, everyone. It's been great spending part of our day with you. And thank you for being with us. And of course, call us about anything at 877-869-8253 or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. We'll talk with you tomorrow.